your perspective on quality from the point of view of the patient or the consumer of healthcare. I know you've had some discussion about managed care. I suspect many of you, if not all of you, will get some exposure to issues of health policy and issues of cost of care. I want to deal with those issues tangentially, essentially viewing them as a consequence of the construct of what quality is, as opposed to a driver for what quality is. So I'd like to begin with, essentially, is to ask you, what do you think of when you think about quality, be it in your own health care or your family's health care? Or your friend's health care, what comes to mind in that regard? What does it look like? Don't all chime in. Yes. Competency. Okay. Anything else? So what you mean is that the people that are taking care of you, you want to have a sense that they know what they're doing. Cultural competency, okay.
Sorry.
How about medical competency? Is that important to you? Does that go higher on the list than cultural competency? So you'll take a boorish but competent physician over a culturally competent but medically incompetent. Is that correct? All right, so medical competence. What else? You want access, yeah. Not only do you want this person to know what they're doing, but you actually want them to be available to you, or the system to be available to you. Yeah.
It has to be communication on both sides.
Communication, all right. Great. Anything else?
There's a disconnect between how much people are willing to pay, or governments are willing to pay, or payers are willing to pay, and what's expected.
So the issue is cost.
Cost and lack of consensus.
Lack of consensus, I don't follow you. And I want you to think now, not in terms of a health policy person. I want you to think as an individual receiving health care. That's where I want to start with defining cost. I can go back to cost afterwards, but essentially if healthcare is to serve a community or to serve individuals, before you work on cost, let's figure out what it ought to look like if it's high quality. Would you mean cost out of pocket to you? I mean, you'd be concerned about that. So I think it belongs on the list. Not in the sense of what it costs society, but what it's going to cost you going to have a physical exam by a competent, culturally competent, medically competent, accessible doctor costs $100 with one versus $200 with another. You'd rather pay $100, I assume. Yeah.
Time and personal investment. I want my doctor to spend a lot of time.
So, well, is that communication and time? Let's put that as a subset of communication. You want someone who can talk to you.
Yeah, more than like 10 minutes.
More than 10 minutes, okay, 12.
quality, if you want the best.
What do you mean by that?
The best service that there's out there.
So you want customer service.
Well, I think...
What do you mean by service?
Yeah. I mean like when... I need to go for a surgery. I want the best surgeon, type of thing. Because it talks about competency and that's...
Well, you want them to be medically competent.
You want them to be medically competent.
He or she.
Well, yeah. Like the technology. I want the best technology.
No, technology you want. Okay. Anything else? Yes? You're demanding. Boy, you really want a lot.
I want to
What's that?
I want them to be nice.
That's good. I like that. How about compassion? Does that include nice? You like that? Empathetic? You think yes?
Convenience.
You want to be convenient? Sure. Anything else? Yeah.
Cutting edge science.
Cutting edge. Yeah.
Consistent.
I like that. We're going to fill up three boards here. Yeah?
I want the care to be successful.
So you want an outcome?
Yeah.
Anybody else? It was a big room, so I'm... Yes?
I don't want to wait for an hour for my appointment.
So you don't want them to abuse your time. All right, this looks like a reasonable... list, and if anybody thinks of something that's missing on here, I'm going to ask you to just shout out something that you think we're missing. I want to start here, though. Competent. How do you know they're competent?
A reference.
A reference? That, unquestionably, is probably the most common reason that a patient ends up with a physician. If somebody else told them to go there. How reliable do you think that is?
I guess you're
looking at the person's outcome. Oh, so you're interested, you want an outcome, you want to know quantitatively what their outcomes are. Well, that's a little different from a personal, or the reference essentially is an individual testimonial typically. That doctor treated me and my family well. If you want to know the outcomes of pneumonia care for the average primary care physician in New York State, you think that data is available?
Not yet.
No, it's not.
Not yet.
Yeah. If you want to know the mortality rate from coronary bypass surgery for every surgeon in New York State, you think that data is available?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's on the website for New York State. It's been there for 15 years. So it depends on the specialty, but there are varying degrees to which outcomes measures available. Any other ways to measure competency? Yeah.
So they've had a lot of experience doing that procedure or doing that illness or maybe
experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you ascertain that they had that experience and have that competence? Should you believe them? What's that?
Do a
should you believe them anyway? Yes.
If you're looking for a surgical specialist of some sort, you can ask the nurses in the hospital
if they'll
tell you the truth.
Well, or from a given perspective, yes, I think that's that. So essentially, you triangulate, look for an independent source of confirmation, yes. So you rely on the insurer to tell you whether or not your doctor's competent. That's nice. There's no question. Your insurer would very much like you to do that. And guess what criteria they'd use as to whether or not your doctor's competent or not. Their expense profile. Yes.
I would know where my doctor went to medical school and where they did their
residency. What his credentials are. Board certifications, where they went to school, where they trained. Yeah.
I was going to say,
Okay. Any other ideas as to how one could determine competence? What about the institution that the physician works in? Well, I think all of these are available, but I would say that there is no systematic way. The most common way that patients get to physicians, unquestionably, is through referral, either through friends or through other physicians. And actually, if you look at New York State data, at least for cardiac surgery, mortality rates that are published that initially in the 1990s had wide variations. You would think that that would have had a major impact on referral and institutional referrals of patients. And in fact, it did not. It did not at all. And the most compelling reason that patients generally go even for an operation that has a 5% chance of killing them, the most compelling reason that they'll go where they're going is because it's convenient. And there's lots of data to that effect, including a study of managed care patients in California who, if you look at patient outcomes and where patients went for care, published mortality rates had no influence on patient behavior. And the most important determinant of whether or not a patient went to a given place for an operation was how close it was to their home. And we see a good deal of that even here. The difference in mortality between heart surgeons in New Jersey and New York is a full percentage point less mortality on this side of the river than on the other side of the river. Yet there are about 11,000 patients a year who choose to have heart surgery across the river in the face of that, and many who just won't cross the bridge, despite, I think, what is a arguably meaningful difference in outcomes. But a 1% mortality rate is not enough. A 1-in-100 chance of dying is generally not enough to compel behavior that moves people across convenience borders. Yes?
I think that another one of the factors you have to look at is not only what the mortality is, but what the complexity of the patient is, the individual
business. Well, what you bring up is the subject of risk adjustment, and you can make those comparisons. Both the New York State data and the New Jersey data are done with comparable risk adjustment models. And if you make the comparison with states, New Jersey is not bad. There are other states with considerably higher mortality than New York. But moving people across those borders based on outcomes data has remarkably little effect on the choices that patients make. That being the case, though, there are other layers at which one can provide quality to patients that become identifiable for the patients, perhaps as a surrogate. And that's essentially an institutional approach to managing and reporting outcomes. And towards that end, if you look at institutions like ours, Cleveland Clinic, Stanford, Mayo Clinic, these are institutions where outcomes of the work that is done are published and actually available on the web. That in and of itself should not, if you as an individual consumer, to muddle through this is very complex and I think excessively demanding. However, if you institutions that do this in the first place, the very act of compiling this type of data indicates a concern with outcomes that institutions who don't do it becomes a distinguishing characteristic. So from our perspective as a clinical enterprise within a very complex institution that serves a local community and serves a larger national, international community, we view outcome as the primary determinant of quality for most of what we do. Our view of quality with regard to complex procedures, with regard to major illnesses for which people come to us for surgical therapy, if you want to know whether or not we feel that we want to say that we're delivering a quality product, the most important issue is our outcomes. And how to measure those becomes increasingly complex. Somebody already brought up the issue of risk stratification. If one hospital's mortality rate is 5% and another one's mortality rate is 2%, does that mean that the 2% hospital is better than the 5%? Absolutely not. Even Florence Nightingale described in the 19th century the phenomenon of transferring patients out of hospitals to die to improve the outcomes in the institution of their origin. And that still happens even now. Just a few years ago, one of the low mortality centers in New York was found to have a relationship with a hospice so that any patient who looked like they were going to die would be transferred out of the hospital shortly before the event, would not occur on the mortality score of the institution. The perception was that this was a wonderful place to go have a heart surgery as opposed to being an average place. So risk stratification is one. The other issue is the duration of the outcome that's measured. Are you talking about, does the patient leave the hospital? Are you talking about, does the patient live for a year? Does the patient live for 5 years? Does the patient live for 15 years? And also, what's the quality of life that a patient enjoys after being a patient? And how much data do you think there is available with regard to these things? Lots? Little? Can you go to the web and find this out? It's remarkably variable with, in most cases, for most illnesses, the data is lacking. So the job that we need to do to better document these outcomes is prodigious. It's huge. And the logistics of ascertaining the information, the cost of ascertaining the information, and also the issues of privacy that accrue in the process of getting that information are very complex, and I suspect will be worked out to a much greater degree so that somebody in my place talking about this 20 years from now, I hope will be able to tell you what the short and long-term outcome is for hospital-acquired pneumonia in New York City. Right now, that's data that, even if available, is not necessarily credible. You had a question?
No, not really a question, but with the new modifications that Medicare and the reimbursement, the current pay performance initiative, all of this evidence-based medicine is going to be available in the next 10 to 20 years. By 2008, I think you have to have electronic medical records.
Yes, but having electronic medical records does not mean that you necessarily know what patient outcomes are.
Well, and
most of those pay for performance types of initiatives are not payment for outcomes. They're payments for process.
But that's the first step.
It may be the first step, but the notion as to whether or not process necessarily translates into better outcomes is also something that is highly theoretical and is often extrapolated data from clinical trials of effectiveness, or efficacy rather, to population-based effectiveness, which is not necessarily the case. My point here is very, very simply this, that I think all of us could agree that whether or not care is successful ought to be the primary determinant of deciding whether or not healthcare quality is good or bad. My only point to you, and I hope the largest point that you'll take away from this discussion, is our ability to quantitate outcomes right now is remarkably limited. Our ability to measure these things is, I would say, inversely proportional also to the complexity of the care and the illness that you're treating. What do I mean by that? Our ability to tell you the outcomes of patients who have heart, kidney, liver, lung transplants is highly precise. We can tell you that their one-year survival averages for hearts 90%, their 10-year survival averages in the range of 45 to 50%. And that has represented tremendous progress. You know, 30 years ago, the one-year survival from a heart transplant was less than 20%. These are patient populations that are followed intensely, and they're seen repeatedly with repeated visits, generally in highly specialized, organized clinics that are required both by professional standards and now increasingly by government standards to maintain that degree of surveillance. Instead, let's talk about something very common like a hernia. How many people in this room have had a family member themselves have hernia repair? You have any idea what the recurrence rate for hernias is? I have a department that does about 200 hernia repair operations a year, and I can't tell you what our recurrence rate is. And the reasons for that are multiple. It's a short episode of care. It's not a chronic illness. It doesn't require long-term surveillance. If the patient has a recurrence, you think they usually come back to the surgeon that did the original operation? No. Would you? So our ability to quantitate that type of episode of care for an illness that's common but less intense is a lot less than our ability to quantitate very, very intense care. That's not always the case, but particularly for transplantation and processes like that, our quantitative ability is very strong. For another reason also, transplantation is very expensive. And it's not surprising that we want to have quantitative measures of outcome for something for which we pay enormous episodic costs, which for a heart are probably in the range of about $250,000, for a liver probably in the range of about $300,000. And the issue there is how much survival or quality-adjusted survival you're generating for the cost expended. It's not surprising that there's a lot of study given to that. For hernia repair, which let's say costs $10,000 for the combination of the hospitalization, the physician's cost, that type of follow-up is generally not available to assess the quality of that type of episode of care, despite the fact, any idea how many hernia repairs are done in the United States per year? It's about 150,000. So there are enormous gaps in our knowledge of outcomes that can be mitigated to some extent by at least trying to know what you can. So for a hernia repair, for example, hospital outcomes. Should patients die during the process of a hernia repair? Almost never. So if you have a hospital that has a 10% mortality associated with hernia repair, that's not the place that you're going to go to have that done. And although remarkably, especially in community settings, even that type of rudimentary data is still not available. And the credentialing of physicians to do those procedures that are not highly complex is still remarkably loose. Why? Why would a hospital not care whether or not a surgeon's mortality rate is 10% or 2% for a simple procedure? Well, follow the money. If you're a doctor that's admitting patients to a hospital and your outcomes are perhaps substandard compared to another physician in that same hospital, does a hospital administrator necessarily want to disenfranchise his hospital, especially if the doctor will take that patient population to another hospital up the street? This may sound remarkably hypothetical to you. I can tell you that this happens in community hospitals across this state, across this country, routinely, all the time. So outcomes, as I said, are the benchmark by which you want to evaluate it. But again, please understand that the data that we have with regard to measuring outcomes are remarkably primitive. What can we produce now? We now have a departmental database in order to measure outcomes that every patient has an operation. There are about 10,000 patients a year at our hospital. We have in-hospital outcomes data on all of them. So we can tell you the mortality rate for a hernia repair or a gallbladder repair or an appendectomy or a coronary bypass or a heart transplant or anything else, or a cancer operation, anything that we do. However, beyond that, and it's a big logistic problem with regard to our quality right now, measuring those outcomes beyond the hospitalization is complex. One of the things that we are, I think you will see increasingly become reportable, though, is you can buy essentially the Social Security number death index. So if you know the Social Security numbers of your patients, it is becoming possible to track large populations of patients to know the outcomes of those who had a given procedure if you have their Social Security number. Unfortunately, having a Social Security number as potential for a living patient is to track the data is a potential HIPAA violation. So if you don't have permission from your patients to track them over a period of time, you can't. And increasingly, we find ourselves in the position of getting informed consent to do the routine observation in order to surveil outcomes in patients in order to fill in the blanks around this question of how good are our outcomes. But the informatics of it, the privacy issues in this remain extremely complex. I want to leave outcomes, though, for a few minutes and get to these issues, like cultural competency, access, communication, service, consistency, respectful of time, compassionate, empathetic. We would bundle those all together and call that something that you may not want to hear, but we like to use the term customer service. And why is that important from the point of view of a consumer? Consumers have choices. If your doctor can't communicate, doesn't give you time, isn't compassionate, isn't empathetic, even if they have great outcomes, in general, there are other people that are available who can provide you with that degree of customer service that, together with the outcomes produced, we think is a desirable combination. But customer service, patients are customers and have multiple choices. Even with managed care, even with insurance, all the managed care companies essentially allow patients to make choices. That had not been the initial expected construct of managed care, particularly in New York. But essentially, a managed care company cannot sell insurance in New York unless patients have a range of choices to make. And those choices are made, I think, in no small part by these other issues that we just mentioned. But number one, is it convenient? Is it close to my home? Do I have to travel 4 hours by car to get there? Can my spouse meet me in a convenient environment? Customer service is still convenience. The reason that there are a multiplicity of highly complex hospital services across the United States arguably is simply the fact that patients want convenience. And we do have a marketplace where patients can make choices. The last thing that's not on this list, except maybe for this, is that healthcare should be cutting edge. Now, is that always the case? If you're going to have your eyeglasses adjusted, do you necessarily want a cutting edge solution? Somebody say no? Does anybody feel differently about that?
Okay.
It Depends on what?
If you have a unique case for your special needs.
If you have a unique case, but you're the average case having a routine eye exam in order to adjust your vision, or you're going for a routine physical, or you're going for a routine hernia repair, do you want a cutting edge solution for problems to which there are a good solution? I see a confusion. Yes?
I think it would be good to have choice. I'm just remembering the last time I went to got my eyes checked. The doctor's office had like a new machine where instead of getting the eye drops,
right,
that dilate your pupil and everything, you could just go in for a few minutes for an extra $50, $60, sit for like 5 minutes, and then they would take a picture of the eye, and you have the results right there. Maybe look at the, you know, so you don't have the inconvenience of, you know, having to wear the dark sunglasses. So if you have the money, then you would go for that option. But if you didn't, then, so I would make choice in the team, stuff like that.
Okay. Let me take another more concrete example. You have pain in your hand all the time, and aspirin does a great job in relieving it. And some new COX-2 inhibitor comes along, and it costs 10 times as much as the aspirin that you were going to take. Do you want the cutting-edge medicine, or do you want the original medicine? Well, who voted for the biopsy here? Unless your view of life is that if it's more expensive, it's better. There are lots of reasons in many circumstances to not view being cutting edge as desirable at all. And if anything, you're looking for a degree of conservatism around things where the established standard produces good outcomes. If I tell you that what I'm going to do is going to make you feel better, it's going to cost very little, it's a solution that's been around for 100 years, but still works. If somebody wants to convince you to be cutting edge in that circumstance, generally, I don't think you want to be cutting edge. But let's turn this around instead to an illness like pancreatic cancer. Where the five-year survival rate, any idea what the pancreatic cancer five-year survival rate is? Or just lung cancer?
Very low.
Low. How low?
Less than 5%.
Yeah, it's less than 5%. And we have lots of standard treatments for pancreatic cancer. We have a big operation that was invented here that's called a pancreatic duodenectomy. We're very proud of the fact that we have made this a very safe operation. It used to carry about a 20-30% mortality. It's been reduced to about a 2-3% mortality rate. But if you look at it objectively, we would say that the only progress that we've made in this field is we've taken an ineffective operation and made it safe. But we haven't made it effective. And if you're looking for an outcome better than 5% at 5 years, would you take a chance on doing something innovative faced with that? Show of hands. Sure. If the outcomes of standard work themselves, if our standard outcome is poor, then you want a place where you're going to have a much larger appetite for innovation than you would otherwise. So to say that quality is simply dependent upon outcomes in the face of illness that's severe and for which the standard outcomes are poor, I think most logical consumers are going to have a very high appetite for an innovative approach to the illness. And conversely, I think one can always want to have that cutting-edge approach, which for standard problems that are low risk, for low risks you don't take, for low gain you don't take high risk. For high gain, you take high risk. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I feel like the comment before about going to the eye doctor and out of the new machine you're talking about.
So sure.
Dilating your eyes. I mean, to me, like, we keep keep saying, like, logically, it seems like, you know, we're going to go for the cutting edge or for the pancreatic cancer. But, I mean, I feel like the comment that was made before that if she wanted to pay the $50, $60 extra to get her eyes looked at, then, you know, I mean, to not have to not being able to see anything. And we keep saying this is logical, but this is within a certain context. I mean, it's logical in general, but
I think the example that we heard with regard to having your eyes examined by a fancy new machine is essentially cutting edge with regard to customer service. Because ultimately the outcome is 6 hours after the appointment you're going to see or not wear your sunglasses to begin with. And if it's important to you to have that 6 hours, be my guest, pay the $60. As long as there's no downside risk to you going blind over.
But, I mean, what I was saying is that, like this, when we say that it's logical or not logical, like, I guess I just feel like within the context of whether you have the money in the first place to make a logical or to be able to make a choice, like,
I think you're talking about two things then. I think the first thing we're talking about is risk. And the other that we're talking about is cost. Now, with regard to cost, if I want 6 hours less time, do you think Medicaid ought to pay for that?
Yes. It won't, but yeah.
Well, if you want to make the Medicaid budget, you know, $90 billion instead of $45 billion, then I think everybody would get the $60 extra eye exam. On the other hand, should Medicaid pay to make available cutting-edge treatments for pancreatic cancer?
Yes.
And should that be independent of ability to pay?
Yes.
And I think the answer to that is yes. That essentially, underwriting this whole issue of cost is everybody ought to be entitled to good outcomes if we're going to have a high-quality medical care delivery service. But everybody does not necessarily get entitlement to outstanding customer service. Should everybody be able to be in a hospital suite recovering from an operation? I think the answer to that is no. If people who want to pay $1,000 extra to be in a hospital suite want to be in the hospital suite, it's like being in the first class section of an airplane. Everybody, if you're going from New York to Boston, the outcome you're looking for is to get to Boston. If it's important to you to sit in a bigger seat for that hour and a half, then go ahead and pay for it, but don't ask everybody else to pay for it. That, I think, now becomes a framework essentially on which to build an acceptable cost structure or an acceptable payable structure for what ought to be reimbursed in healthcare. Yes?
So how do you then explain sort of the converse of that with birth, where birth is better outcomes if you go the more low-tech route for normal laboring women?
All right.
And yet the mode that has been for the last how many years has been four more C-sections and more intervention, and it's pretty much the exact opposite.
I think your point is well taken, except for the initial premise, which was that low-tech birth is lower risk than high-tech birth. At least our own institutional experiment in that was disastrous, where we essentially put nurse midwife service up at our Allen Pavilion Hospital. Outcomes were terrible, lawsuits galore, saved money, maimed a lot of babies.
Well, Allen Pavilion also didn't have the appropriate setup for midwives to actually practice midwifery. I mean, you know, get rid of the external monitoring, get rid of the actual technology and let midwives practice as midwives in a low-tech situation as opposed to just putting midwives in hospitals and expecting midwifery outcomes.
And selecting boxes are clear, and so are mine.
Is there a response?
Is there a response? Sure. I think there are often the best intentions result in horrendous outcomes. So to think that a complex process like childbirth, which has a low but finite incidence of infant and maternal morbidity and mortality, how best to handle that? I'm sure there's not one best way. But how to select patients who ought to be treated in one way versus treated in another way is an extremely complex issue that I can't say that I can necessarily create an answer to. Added to it also is the cost piece of this now is also the medical liability cost attached to this, which is enormously distorting. Our typical obstetricians now have malpractice premiums of about $300,000 a year. That ultimately is a huge discouragement to anybody going into this field, but there have been judgments in the stratosphere that really could create a defensive posture in this type of circumstance as well. I don't have an easy answer to it, but in particular for routine things where there are lots of different ways to do it and lots of strongly held beliefs about how to do it, those are areas where there are going to continue to be controversies around how best to accomplish it. And from the point of the consumer, there are a lot of consumers who want exactly what you just described, low-tech, at-home, no monitors, no bleeping, routine childbirth. There are a lot of other consumers who wouldn't even think about doing that. And I think at this, and that's a customer service issue to some extent as well. So which do you want to pay for? You yourself can make some of that judgment as well. Yes.
Along with this, we're talking about customer service, and I think the difference in the points of view here has to be that you have to individualize the treatment of the patient. And if you select the procedure with two criteria in mind, one, is the patient appropriate for this particular procedure, along with what the patient really wants, then you're going to have the best of both worlds.
So the two words that I heard were appropriate. Is it appropriate for the procedure and what the patient wants? And I think that's a very important set of questions. Because what does appropriate mean?
Medically appropriate.
What does medically appropriate mean?
If somebody's high risk, then you're not going to want to put them in a birthing suite far from specific.
Should that also, if they know that, whose choice should that be?
I think it has to be the patient's choice, but the patient has to be well informed by a doctor who can communicate with that patient.
I think that's fair, but ultimately I think patients now are the ones who ultimately answer the risk-reward question. And arguably that ought to be part of the whole communication thing with regard to what does it take to communicate with a patient viably. If communication means you're going to come to me and paternalistically or maternalistically, a physician is going to say, this is what I think is best for you, so do it. Is that adequate communication?
No.
Is that true for everybody?
No.
No. There are a lot of people, there are still a large number of people who want to do what bioethicists call autonomy dumping. They want to go to their doctor and they want to say, this is my set of circumstances, I want you to take care of me and do what you think is best. I think that that is increasingly uncommon in this culture. There are still cultures like Japan where this is absolutely the cultural norm. But on the other hand, if a patient is going to make these judgments, essentially it becomes a risk-reward discussion. And the risks include physical risks, economic costs, time lost, pain, suffering, all those things. And the reward, presumably, what should the reward be?
Well,
Should the reward be that my CAT scan looks better? Should it be? What should the reward be?
The outcome
that you're proposing. What does that mean? What outcome?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about, what the procedure is. If you're talking about birth, well, obviously, they're looking to have a healthy child and safe and all that. Yeah. Or if you're talking about a physical, they want to know if something's wrong.
Well, I think what I'm trying to get at is that the reward essentially is to be alive. that's number one. In most instances, that's the reward. And the second part of the reward is that you feel well. And anything that you're willing to take risk for, if you can't answer that risk-reward question, is this going to make me feel better or live longer or both? If the answer to that is no, what should you do? Nothing. Even if someone tells you that it's appropriate that you should have a given treatment or a given procedure, if that can't be understood to a patient in plain English or Spanish or Farsi, that the reason that you potentially would subject that patient to risk and pain and suffering, if the reward for that is not crystal clear and understood well and presented fairly as to what its likelihood is, then I don't think you've had effective communication. On the other hand, that kind of communication can get extremely complex and very quantitative and arguably very statistical. And that's not an easy problem to solve. Well, let me put this in a particular context. Somebody in this room, I'm sure, has had appendicitis. Did you have an appendectomy? Why did you have an appendectomy? I'm sure it hurt like hell.
I had all the symptoms.
Right.
And I knew of a person who didn't get it done and died. And I was on the phone talking to the doctor, and I said to him, it's my understanding if I don't get this done and it is what I think it is, I could die. He said, yes. Right. I said, I think I should go to the emergency room. He goes, that's a good idea.
Right. So you basically thought of this as a life and death decision that was obvious to you. Anybody else? Yes?
I had an appendectomy, but I didn't remember the question.
Why did you have it? You think you would have died otherwise? It's a true story about a baseball player with a multi-million-dollar contract up for renewal who wanted to have a good season and develops appendicitis during the middle of the baseball season. And refuses an operation. Understandable? Why?
It can be done laparoscopically with a recovery of a couple of weeks. It can be back.
Oh, but it's anybody's. And I've had laparoscopic operations myself.
I mean, I was back playing basketball, you know, mid-season.
You're young. Oh, but this is worth millions of dollars to him in terms of that contract.
It's actually understandable. Regards to the person, how does the person feel being by doctor?
What question are you not asking? Well, but the postulate here is that you have the operation and live, or don't have the operation and die. Yes. Right. And what's the likelihood of recovering from a bout of acute appendicitis with antibiotics? It's about 90%. And this was not the case 30 years ago. But the real reason that patients have appendectomy, we still recommend appendectomies now, is because the likelihood of their getting a recurrent acute appendicitis is still in the 10 to 20% range if they're treated with antibiotics. And the operation is so low risk that it's something that we routinely recommend at this point. But the reason is no longer life and death. And this guy's decision was an entirely perfectly, would you take, if I offered you $10 million to delay having an appendectomy for 4 months,
with a 10% chance that you'll have recurrent appendicitis and need the appendectomy that we would do right now. For $10 million, would you wait the 4 months? Sure you would. Yeah, I would too. So what seemed like, there was all kinds of press around this being an insane decision, and the guy was suicidal and everything else. The point I make is that it's very important to understand the risk of versus alternatives. And those alternatives need to be, I think, precisely spelled out. And the choices that are made can very well depend upon the particular life circumstances of the person making the choices. And with that, I think I'll stop at this point and summarize. The most important determinant in quality of health care is measurable outcomes. Unfortunately, the amount of information that we have with regard to those outcomes is surprisingly poor in light of all the informatics and all the databases that we have and all the knowledge that we have of medical care, the availability, precision, reliability of measures that we have is remarkably poor. Two other components of quality of health care are arguably customer service in terms of choices that people can make, the kinds of communication they want to have, the sense of compassion, empathy, availability. And from a consumer point of view, all those customer service issues arguably play into their decisions as to who to choose and what to choose in terms of what to do. And third, innovation is a key part of health quality as well. But it can cut both ways. The innovation simply for the sake of innovation can actually be quite dangerous. And by comparison, a responsible approach to innovation based on risk versus reward is a reasonable determinant of whether or not to seek the more cutting-edge solution, not to mention analysis of what the proposed cutting-edge solution is itself. But if you come away from this set of discussions thinking in terms of outcomes, innovation, customer service, I think you'll understand, at least from a consumer viewpoint, the basis for most types of healthcare decisions and behaviors at this point, and how to fit that into issues of policy and cost structure and the like are very complex and well beyond this type of discussion. But I hope that this will provide a framework for that for you. So thank you.
There are one or two questions that people have about quality that haven't come up. It's been quite an interactive conversation already, but if there are one or two questions people have, I'm sure Dr. Wilson will be happy to stick around for a minute or two.